You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Grand Canyon University, an affordable private Christian university, is one of the largest and fastest growing universities in the country, offering more than 270 programs online. In addition to federal grants and aid, GCU's online students received nearly $130 million in institutional scholarships in 2022. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu/myoffer to see the scholarships you may qualify for.
We all know how important it is to keep your eye on the money, and not just your own. Stay on top of the latest financial and market news with Yahoo Finance, a podcast that releases new episodes almost every day. You'll hear a brief overview of the biggest news in the financial world, all in 3 minutes or less, right after markets close. Check out Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts. That's Yahoo Finance wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. From an early age, Samantha Power has had a passion for human rights and helping the most desperate people in the world. This former journalist personally witnessed the horrors of the war in Bosnia, won a Pulitzer Prize for her heart-wrenching account of 20th century genocide, and advocated for human rights as the founding executive director of the Carr Center for Human Rights Policy at Harvard University's Kennedy School of Government. But then her writing got the attention of a young Senator Barack Obama and changed her life forever. She went from being an advocate working outside of the government to working on the inside at the highest level on the President's National Security Council and then as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. She quickly gained an appreciation for the complexity of decision-making at the top, the gray areas that plague even the most seemingly black and white issues, and the unintended consequences of action and inaction. And yet, at the end of her 8 years in the Obama administration, Samantha Power's belief in fighting for those who can't fight for themselves and the power of diplomacy to make a better world was not only intact, but strengthened by the experience. It's something she writes about in her new best-selling book, The Education of an Idealist, a memoir. The Education of an Idealist has been listed as one of the best books of 2019 by the New York Times, NPR, Time, Economist, The Washington Post, and Publishers Weekly. And today, Ambassador Power joins me on the podcast to talk about it. She recalls her early years as a freelance journalist covering the Siege of Sarajevo, her first impression of a first-term Senator Barack Obama, how she navigated the politics of the West Wing, earned the president's trust, and got his attention on critical humanitarian issues. She gives an inside account of the negotiations leading up to the Paris Climate Accord, the discussions in the Oval Office over how to handle the Syrian civil war, and how the Obama administration's scramble the jets approach to the Ebola crisis could be a case study in how to handle future humanitarian crises. Plus, she talks about the rise of China, America's loss of moral authority under President Donald Trump, and why she views empathy as one of her greatest strengths in diplomacy. Coming up with Ambassador Samantha Power in just a moment. Samantha Power is a professor of practice at Harvard Kennedy School and Harvard Law School. Power, who began her career as a journalist reporting from places like Bosnia, East Timor, Rwanda, and Sudan, authored the Pulitzer Prize-winning book, A Problem from Hell, America and the Age of Genocide, and the bestseller, Chasing the Flame, One Man's Fight to Save the World. Samantha Power worked on President Barack Obama's National Security Council as Special Assistant to the President for Multilateral Affairs and Human Rights, and then became the youngest person ever to serve as U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations from 2013 to 2017. Now Samantha Power writes about her experience in a new book titled The Education of an Idealist, a memoir. Ambassador Power, welcome.
Great to be here. I love the name of your podcast, too. You have the best name, the Kick-Ass Podcast. I mean, who could do better than that?
So
it's like, who would not want to listen to that?
Well, I have to tell you, I've had your husband, Cass Sunstein, on the show, I think at least once, maybe twice now. And he is such a brilliant guy. And I remember telling him, Cass, you are the greatest guest, but you know that I'm really dying to get your wife on the show. And he's like, I know. So I'm thrilled to finally have you on the show.
He's not crazy about being an intermediary. It'll shock you to hear. Whenever he gets an email saying, can you put me in touch with your wife? He has a very grumpy reaction. I'm not sure why. It's what most women have dealt with in marriages for a very long time.
Right. Well, I have to say that he just talks about you in glowing terms. You can tell that he really loves you and has the utmost admiration for his wife, which is really sweet to see. I enjoyed this book very much, but I have to say, it ended up being very different from what I was expecting. Just going off of the title, I suppose that I probably assumed that The Education of an Idealist was sort of a polite way of saying The Disillusionment of an Idealist. I guess I thought that it was going to be a book about the conflict between idealism and realpolitik. But it's really not that. After going from being the outsider and this human rights champion to being on the inside of government at the highest levels and seeing how the sausage really gets made, how is it that you're not jaded and you seem to have come out of it with your idealism still intact?
Yeah, more than intact, I think. As you say, more savvy and experienced in the ways of the world and in what it takes to get things done, I think, mainly. That is sort of highest on my list of lessons from my time in government, but also even from my time in journalism, understanding where journalism does and doesn't make a difference. But I think the reason I'm not jaded is, first, I don't think being jaded is likely, just for practical reasons, to get anybody out of bed and fired up to go do anything during the day that'll make anything better anywhere. Mm-hmm. So even if I were jaded deep down, I would find it an impractical approach to the human condition. I have a line you might remember in the book from Amos Tversky, the late, great Israeli social psychologist, who says, I'm not a pessimist. I'm an optimist, because if I were a pessimist, I would suffer twice. and so part of it lies there, but mainly it's because in all these different incarnations that I've been privileged to have as an activist, a columnist, a teacher, a professor, a writer, and then finally in the government and as a diplomat, I just saw how individual agency could make such a profound difference.
I also want to ask you to talk about some of the areas where you feel that you made a difference, but perhaps because we're psychologically hardwired to focus more on dangers and failures than the wins, particularly incremental wins tend to get overshadowed. What are some accomplishments during your time in the Obama administration that you feel might have gotten overlooked or overshadowed by the big headline-grabbing events?
You know, the very high-profile areas during the Obama years where we did not move the needle sufficiently to improve lives or save lives. Syria, of course, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, is the best example of that. But for every Syria, there is an Iran nuclear deal where mm-hmm. you see diplomacy, really complicated diplomacy on very technical issues with Russia, China, Europeans and others at the table, but giving rise to a peaceful end to Iran's nuclear program. The Ebola story, which I tell in the book, of, you know, building the airplane while you're flying it and getting the U.S. military to go in along with, you know, a couple thousand U.S. health workers into West Africa, dealing with the Ebola catastrophe at its source so that it wouldn't come to the United States. And then really small, modest initiatives like the one that I and my team undertook at the U.N. of trying to get female political prisoners out of jail and just making a very simple, small list of 20 around the world, China, Uzbekistan, Egypt, Ethiopia, a bunch of different countries, and using social media, teaming up with Republican and Democratic female senators in Washington who, and even in those days, weren't agreeing on much of anything but threw their weight behind this campaign and helping secure the release of 16 of those 20 women. So from the small to the large, you just really up close and working within a country as powerful as the U.S., especially, you know, to have that privilege, I could really see the difference that individuals were making, and particularly the civil servants and the foreign service, who now we've heard from in their public testimonies for all the wrong reasons. But nonetheless, I think you get a flavor for what I got to work with for 8 years within the Obama administration, of just these people who serve, no matter who the president is, who come from very different walks of life, bring very different forms of expertise, but who want to serve the Constitution, the American people, the rule of law, and, you know, they make political appointees like me look a lot smarter than we are. And that's one reason you are able to do so much, is the lifeblood of the U.S. government are these individuals who serve without a lot of glamour and pay.
Another good example of a win that maybe didn't get a lot of attention is your efforts to help Iraqi refugees. Talk a little about that.
So one of those issues was Iraqi refugees, where I had a really important ally on some human rights issues. You know, some of my close colleagues would oppose my perspective, for example, if I wanted to cut off military assistance to a government that had been committing abuses. There might be a longstanding military-to-military relationship that the Defense Department wanted to maintain. On Iraqi refugees, we were in lockstep because the U.S. military had benefited so much from Iraqi and Afghan translators, interpreters who had risked their lives and now were facing death threats. But our refugee admissions process was not privileging these case files. Indeed, you know, and especially as a few months into the administration, the refugee admissions process was beginning to kind of grind to a halt for a set of complicated reasons. And we knew we needed really intense vetting because you can't let anybody into the country that's going to pose a national security threat. And the vetting has to be done in a manner that is also not duplicative and that's not creating excess delay. And so it's all this kind of red tapey, wonky stuff that if you had asked me 10 years before, would you have a taste for cutting through red tape, I would have thought I was temperamentally ill-suited for that. But when it came to thinking about these interpreters whose lives were on the line and whose families' lives were on the line simply because of the sacrifice they had made working with U.S. forces, it was so motivating that the red tape, it became infinitely interesting. And so I think managing to work with the intelligence community, the counterterrorism agencies, the State Department and others to get the proper system put in place, and then to see those individuals coming to this country or getting reunited with their families, I mean, it's immensely gratifying.
You also talk about how the same scramble the jets approach America used for warfare could be and should be deployed for humanitarian purposes, such as addressing the Ebola crisis and even climate change. Now, you helped shepherd through the Paris Climate Change Accord, which now every Democrat running for president says they're going to rejoin. But you also say in here that that's not sufficient to meet the level of threat right now. So what else do you think needs to happen?
You know, on climate change, if we begin to turn the tide, no pun intended, it will not be because a group of states came together and, you know, negotiated the successor to the Paris Agreement in a more ambitious way. It'll be because citizens, companies, local officials, young people especially, are just claiming this and refusing to accept these, you know, kind of either the inaction that we see in some countries like ours or just these more incremental steps that aren't going to get us where we need to go.
And you mentioned a moment ago your previous life as a journalist. When you were just 23 years old, you took off on your own to cover the war in Bosnia. You were just a freelance journalist, so you had no news organization backing you up, no team around you to keep you out of harm's way in the middle of a war zone. How in the world was it that you were not scared out of your mind to go into that situation?
I was scared out of my mind.
Okay.
I was most definitely scared out of my mind. I mean, there was a community of freelance journalists just like me who had descended, whether on Belgrade or on Zagreb, Croatia, or Sarajevo, and with just a kind of dedication to telling the story of ethnic cleansing. Remember what Bosnia was at the time. It was this, seemed like an anomaly because the Cold War had just ended. The Soviet Union had dissolved. Freedom was on the march. NGOs were proliferating, civil society all around the world. And then there was this pesky ethnic conflict where people were being targeted on the basis of their religion and their ethnicity. And so many young people flocked to the Balkans and ahead of me, certainly. You know, in 1992, I arrived at the end of 1993 in terms of like posting there full time. And they were incredibly welcoming. They, by the time, let's say they'd been there a year, they might have access to an armored car or know how to get cash when you're living under siege. You know, again, this is part of my education at a very early stage. But without that kind of community of colleagues and what would become my closest friends in this world, many of them were in my wedding as bridesmaids because there were a lot of women at the heart of the press corps. But I wouldn't have known what to do, and I'm not sure I would have even come back safely. I mean, it was such a perilous existence. But I did it, as I would recommend if anybody else wants to embark on this kind of life. I just did it very, very gradually, right? I didn't go from being completely green to living under siege in Sarajevo. I kind of dipped my toe in. My first ever story, as I read in The Education of an Idealist, was about the one UN-declared safe area, which was a term of art that the UN used, and there were six safe areas all told, but I went to the one that was actually safe. The other five were the most dangerous places in Bosnia, and I wrote a story about why the one UN safe area was actually safe. Why was it safe? What a great story in order to stay safe yourself. And so that was my first time in Bosnia, and I went, then my next trip was to cover a ceasefire, and I gradually sort of learned the ways of the road before I put myself in very perilous circumstances. And of course, there's a bit of hubris involved at the time you cross that threshold of believing somehow that you can take precautions when you know deep down that you can't. But I was lucky, and I was helped and supported in large and small ways by my colleagues.
And you ended up writing about the experience in your book, A Problem from Hell, which not only won you a Pulitzer Prize, but it got the attention of a young Senator Barack Obama. What was your first impression of Senator Obama?
Mm-hmm. Well, he did reach out after reading the book. He had just been elected to the U.S. Senate, and he was, first of all, already a celebrity. You know, probably he would be the first to admit more of a celebrity than he was at that time an impactful U.S. senator. The Senate was gridlocked, not quite to the extent of today, but not that far from it. It was the least productive Congress since the so-called Do-Nothing Congress of Harry Truman's time. And that Do-Nothing Congress, which had that label, actually managed to get the Marshall Plan through. So the Congress in which Barack Obama began serving his first term was even less productive, was less productive, I should say, than that one. And but he was, you could see he saw his utility as being also in terms of agenda setting. The Democratic Party had just come off of this bruising loss where John Kerry had been defeated by George W. Bush, and there was a soul-searching going on. And even though he was new, he saw himself as having a critical role in that process. And for me personally, I wasn't sure what I had to offer him. I had written this book on American responses to genocide, a relatively narrow slice of the U.S. foreign policy puzzle. But he actually saw the work that I had done in broader terms than perhaps I did even.
Really? How so?
He saw the U.S. non-response to Rwanda as actually being of a piece with the disastrous U.S. invasion of Iraq. That is, a sin of omission and a sin of commission had an awful lot in common, not least the neglect of thinking about human consequences at the highest levels of decision making. And that was what he really, you know, kind of put his finger on and asked, you know, what would it look like to restructure how the executive branch sort of did its business to ensure that human consequences were elevated? You know, what part would come from presidential leadership? What part would be bottom up? How would you do staffing differently? I mean, he's just really nuts and bolts, curious and open. There was a kind of he was unsatisfied by the kind of answers that I would normally get away with, on a talk show or even in a classroom. And he would always have a follow up to a follow up to a follow up question. And you know, wasn't there, as some politicians do, you know, kind of asking a question in order to get a response that will trigger their soliloquy on what should be done and their pre-existing kind of canned answer. He was very unformed and wanted to stay that way for as long as he could. He really wanted to explore, what a tough and principled and humane foreign policy could look like. And so I was hooked. And at the dinner, I described in my book, actually, all the times I thought, well, should I ask him if I could come work with him? Would that be pushy? Would he just be horrified? I mean, what does an academic have to offer him, especially as somebody who's been a scholar of genocide? But I knew just instinctively that I could learn from him and that I could be a junior partner to him as he explored some of these questions, because I didn't have the answers myself. And I felt there was an awful lot of rethinking that needed to be done, given the number of taboos in American foreign policy, kind of issues you couldn't touch, that he seemed willing to probe. Mm. And so at the end of this first dinner, I finally got up my gumption and said, how would you feel if I came and kind of hung out in your office for a year and you don't have to pay me and I just want to be part of this? And I think he was shocked.
When you were first getting to know Barack Obama and sort of feeling him out, did you get any inkling that he was seriously thinking of running for president?
One of the first questions I asked him before volunteering to come work for him was, you know, there are rumors that even though you just got to the Senate, you might be running for president. And he was like, nah, yeah, how presumptuous would that be? I just got here. I'd have to start running in, you know, in a year. That would be crazy. And of course, in fact, he did start running in a little over a year. And so I got to be part of the campaign as well. But it was interesting how far from his mind the idea of running for president was and how much that changed.
That's interesting. How do you think he came around to the idea?
I think it just nagged at him, this gap between his own expanding stature and his kind of global celebrity and his ability to pass a bill or do anything for anybody. I think he felt the limits of the position as senator, and he was concerned after 8 years of George W. Bush. He really felt like it was important to make a fresh start. And so he did end up going back on not a promise he made to me, but I think on his own way of thinking about his time in the Senate. And of course, by late 2006, was pretty clear that he was going to make a run for it starting in 2007.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more when we come back in just a minute. And after the election, you were brought over to the White House as a member of President Obama's National Security Council. You say that then you felt very much frozen out because just access to the president is so tightly controlled in that situation. What was the key to getting back in the inner circle?
I think being effective fundamentally. Mm-hmm. I initially was a bit bruised. I had been close to Senator Obama in the Senate and then close to him on the campaign. And then suddenly there were these layers that I hadn't really expected. You know, of course, it stood to reason I wouldn't be able to email him or, you know, have walk-in office privileges in the Oval Office at the outset or anything like that. I knew that. But there were people who didn't fundamentally either weren't curious about my perspective or actually had an active interest in, in sort of keeping me on the outside. And so I got great advice from the late, great diplomat Richard Holbrooke, who said, you know, you can sit here and whine about your access, or you can go do some things in the government. And the main reason to do things in the government is you may not have a job like this again. To be the president's human rights advisor is such a privileged role to have. There are so many communities in the world who don't get White House attention, and you have the chance to bring that attention. You should go where other people aren't, instead of wanting to flock to the big policy questions where 50 senior officials are talking in circles. And Holbrooke was funny. He said, you know, Many of the meetings you're desperate to get into are meetings. The very same meeting will happen again next week. You know, these are meetings that aren't yielding conclusions, not because of Obama, but they're really complex, right? The question of what to do about Afghanistan and whether to surge our troops, and so I went off and just worked on a few discrete issues, and really, in a way, used my own learning on those issues, my own deep dive into those issues to myself also get better at working the bureaucracy and learning. It doesn't matter if an issue is in the headlines. Again, if you can use these positions to do good, even small good, it's a luxury and a privilege you may not get again. And so I really tried to make the most of my time and had a list that I kept taped up next to my computer of the affirmative agenda items that I wanted to get done on behalf of President Obama. And then as word got out that I was able to get these things done, then, you know, people working in the government want to have you around, because if you know how to work the government and create coalitions and work with other countries, that's an invaluable set of skills. So once I had those skills, then it was less about getting into a meeting to be in a meeting. It was more about what specifically or how are you going to add value when you get there.
So just kind of keeping your nose to the grindstone and gradually earning your place at that table. And there are also these moments in the book where I guess you haven't had that much one-on-one contact with POTUS and you're trying to be heard on an issue, and he'll say something like, okay, you know, we should get together so you can tell me everything I'm doing wrong. Or he'll say, I know, we've all read your book, Samantha. Did you almost feel that you had to be mindful of not being, for lack of a better word, too much of a Debbie Downer for fear that the president might duck you in the hallways or you wouldn't be able to get his ear anymore?
It was, I think, the key to not, you know, igniting his, or irritating him or igniting his ire was, you know, trying to put myself in his shoes and try to think to myself, okay, what constraints stand in his way? I have this thing I think we should do as a government. He and I, you know, see things largely the same way, the same values. We care above all, of course, about advancing U.S. interests and see those as linked often, though sometimes there are trade-offs. And so if he's not agreeing with me, he's probably not agreeing with me for some decent reason. And so I better think really hard about that reason and meet him where he is. And I think when President Obama found himself, you know, talking in circles, or found the rest of us talking in circles, that's when he would show some irritation. But when I wasn't in meetings or when I was quiet in meetings, you know, he'd say, "What do you have, the flu? You know, what do you got to say for yourself? Don't give me that look." You know, he'd spot, because I sometimes, when I was UN ambassador, I'd often be on the big screen rather than in person, because I might be running across the street to do a negotiation with the Chinese on North Korea or something. And so I couldn't always get down to Washington to be there in person. And, you know, I wasn't in the room to see it, but I think my face was enormous. It was like this huge, imagine like the biggest Super Bowl screen you ever saw, and it was my face. And so, and I'm not a poker player and don't have a poker face in the best of circumstances. So I think he would see that skepticism and then try to bring me out. Yeah. And I, you know, that's, again, the kind of leadership you need somebody who, even if it's hard for them to hear dissenting views, Obama just got fundamentally that he needed to hear. He's human. He wants to hear what he wants to hear, but he knows that he needs to hear what he needs to hear. And that is a really important quality of leadership. So I was never shut out of those kinds of discussions.
Yeah. And Syria was one of those areas where you didn't entirely see eye to eye with President Obama. And indeed, there were many different opinions and interests at the table, and incredibly high stakes to boot. Take us inside the room for those discussions.
I think every one of those meetings that we had on Syria, because it was just so hard to find a fresh path that would bring about, that was would convince the president that it would bring about a meaningful change on the ground, that even if I tried to meet him where he was, there was a kind of background despair, really, or a background exasperation that just every proposed path forward carried with it such risks risks that particularly in the wake of the war in Iraq, the president wasn't prepared to take. Mm-hmm. And so that led to the kind of tension that you're describing where he's like, yeah, we've all read your book, you know. But I'd say, well, no, actually, what I'm describing is not in my book. There's nothing to do with my book. It has to do with, you know, what we do about this group of civilians that's huddled up against the border because the Turkish government won't let them in, or, you know, what we do about the Chemical Weapons Convention, given that we have an interest in seeing that enforced. So what I do in the book is try to bring people into the gray zones, you know, because it's, again, there's no absolute right and wrong when you are employing a tool when you don't, you of course can't predict how it's going to go. You use your judgment and your experience to make an assessment of the good that it's going to do. But, you know, very reasonable people had very different perspectives, mm-hmm. again, on the costs and benefits of different ideas that we were exploring.
How did the president go about making decisions in that kind of scenario where there's no clear path and a lot of different opinions in a room? How do you break the logjam and move forward?
Well, I definitely internalized pretty early a phrase that he used, which I think applies to all walks of life, which is, mm-hmm. let's not admire the problem. You know, there was a tendency especially when there were no easy solutions, which pretty much everything that came to Obama's desk, it was coming to him by definition because it couldn't be resolved at a lower level by, you know, people who were, all things considered, quite like-minded. And so it was, if it was coming to him, it was going to be a hard issue. And when it's a hard issue, there is a human tendency to kind of, you know, get very precise about the diagnosis, the history, you know, the parallels in other places, you know, which has nothing to do with how you find, it has something, it's a context, but it's not going to move you toward figuring out, you know, what trade-off you make or what lesser evil you embrace. And so I think I just temperamentally have an aversion to admiring the problem myself. And so I would rarely kind of drone on about, you know, what the human consequences were. I knew also that Obama would be very alert, for example, on Syria, to the human toll of that conflict. I didn't have to remind him how many people had died or that incendiary weapons were being used or chemical weapons or barrel bombs. I mean, he knew all that.
And in your book, I get a real sense that the plight of oppressed peoples, especially those caught in the middle of the Syrian civil war, is something that you take very personally. And it takes me back to that wonderful documentary by Greg Barker, The Final Year, when I can see in your eyes that you were really affected by the Syrian crisis and frustrated with the foot dragging to the point of being almost on the verge of tears. It was just so clear that this wasn't all theoretical for you. You really cared, and those lives mattered to you in a way that I rarely see from diplomats and politicians. Do you think empathy is an underrated and underutilized skill in politics and world affairs?
Yeah, I mean, I did care. I do care. And I think that that's a strength. I mean, I think especially mm-hmm. when it comes to women, you know, there have been some social sanctions through the years, you know, of showing that you care, you know, being seen somehow as too feminine or too emotional or too this or that. I mean, to me, it was a strength. And I really tried to convey that to the team of career foreign service officers and civil service officers who I got to work with at the U.S. mission to the U.N. and to diplomats from other countries, say, you know, when you care, like, that's your fuel. That's what gets you to stay, you know, at the office till midnight in a negotiation till the wee hours. You know, that's what gets you when you fail to convince your colleagues internally in the U.S. government, or when you don't yet have the coalition you need up on Capitol Hill. That's what gets you to just not give up and keep working to secure that. So, and I think it comes in part from, I was lucky in a way in my 20s to spend so much time out in the field. And so it's true, when I saw statistics, I you know, just instinctively would sort of pry them apart a little bit and imagine what it would be like to be a parent who's unable to feed a child in Syria because the Syrian government is using food as a weapon of war, or not, and just to not be able to mm-hmm. keep someone you love safe, to not be able to offer that assurance or to be able to escape. I mean, most wars, you can get out of the war zone. It stinks because you have to be a refugee. But with Syria, so many people were trapped in enclaves and they just couldn't leave. They were just subjected to shelling and sniping and starvation tactics, and they were just trapped. And just to imagine, what would it be like to be trapped, well, you know, for any of us? And so I think on, you know, my team of diplomats that I got to work with who stayed on, of course, into the Trump administration as well, these lifelong U.S. diplomats, they really did. I mean, they stayed later. They worked weekends, you know, the sacrifices of being away from their families because they cared. And I think they saw the humans on the other side of those statistics or those more antiseptic briefings that you get sometimes in the U.S. government or at the U.N.
Well, let me ask you this. When you allow yourself to become emotionally invested in the plight of the most desperate people, how do you not take that home with you? I mean, if I was dealing with something with those kind of stakes, it would be all I ever thought about all the time.
I mean, I knew that my time in first as the president's human rights advisor and then as UN ambassador was by definition finite. And so this sense of luxury that I had of being in a position not always to achieve what I set out to achieve, but to try. I mean, imagine, you know, how that felt after years of having been a journalist, a columnist, an activist, trying from the outside to get someone in a job like the one I had to care, and now I was in that job. And I had this team of amazingly talented specialists and language experts, and we had all these embassies around the world. I mean, we could do things. And so even when I was banging my head against the wall, for example, on Syria, I could work with the Russian ambassador to try to get at least one Syrian political prisoner out of jail in a given month. Or I could shift gears entirely and go and work on the Ebola crisis or getting the Paris Climate Agreement across the finish line so that we would begin to, you know, take some of the steps that we needed in order to deal with the climate crisis. So that sense of privilege and gratitude, I guess you could say, a kind of spirit of gratitude, also knowing I wasn't in the situation, you know, I could tuck my kids in at night and you know, be relatively confident that nothing was going to happen in the night, you know, and I felt lucky throughout. So, you know, it's not to say that it didn't get to me or that there weren't heartbreaking moments, but I tried to remember how short my time on the clock was and to wallow or to think that it was about me rather than the issues was going to mean squandering precious time to do something for someone.
Yeah. Now, one topic that seems to lurk in the book throughout your time in the government is what China's rise means for what you're trying to accomplish at the UN and for the United States overall. Tell us a little more about that.
Well, I think it's a complicated question. I mean, definitely China's arrival, you know, guns blazing on the international scene, which has been kind of gradually happening over the last decade, but is really, you're really seeing it today, is a major new factor. It's the most significant transformation of international affairs in my lifetime. I mean, I think you know, it will prove every bit as transformational very soon as the end of the Cold War, and in coming years it'll be even more earth-shattering, really. I mean, it's just the size, the power, the ambition, the very, very different model of governance, but also the fact that the U.S. and China are much more intertwined than the U.S. and Soviet Union were. So some of the tactics that were employed against the Soviet Union just are not going to work against China, given how connected we are economically, especially.
More generally, do you think that it's become more difficult for the U.S. to push back on human rights in places like Syria and Sudan, given that it just pushes those bad actors into the arms of China and Russia today? I mean, any country can forum shop, so how much leverage does the U.S. still have?
I think the better way to look at it, your point is a very good one about China's rise and how significant it is. So there is an issue where a country might say, yeah, you and your human rights concerns, you know, we've got this great new infrastructure project that we're going to do with China and buzz off. And you see some of that. But you also see a couple other dynamics, which is, and this is going to sound sort of old-fashioned or corny, perhaps, but there is a longing that people have everywhere, including in China, even if it's repressed, to be able to hold accountable those people in positions of power who are not doing right by you. But, you know, that, and you just, whether that's what gave rise to the Arab Spring was just a sense of corruption and, you know, such shoddy economic policies and elites getting richer and the youth not getting anywhere near the kinds of investments in their futures that they deserved. And above all, so you can have all those crummy, crummy policies, economic and political policies, but then no method for getting rid of the individuals who are putting those policies in place or perpetuating those policies. And that's what brings people out to the streets. So on the one hand, you definitely have governments inclined to sort of say, oh, we don't have to listen to your human rights, blah, blah, because we've got China that's not going to raise any of those issues with us. But then look at what's happening around the world in Algeria and Sudan, in Hong Kong, you know, where the mighty Chinese military is perched across the border to potentially crack down in even more coercive and violent ways. You know, even in Eastern Europe, where you've seen strongmen ascend in countries like Hungary and Poland, you know, a real kind of beginning, I think, to see the swing of the pendulum, in part because people just don't like state-controlled media. You know, they know the difference between what's true in their lives and what's being said is happening, as state TV, you know, often the old style Soviet tactics, which are back in fashion again in many autocratic countries. But the hunger hasn't gone. And you're also seeing a growing backlash against China's no strings attached investments and also the kinds of debt that China is saddling some of these developing countries with. And so I guess it seems like a very kinetic and volatile time, but not one where the future is foretold.
Well, to take it a little closer to home, how problematic is it that the President of the United States is threatening to crack down on the free press, go after whistleblowers, and investigate political rivals? Do you think that the U.S. has lost some credibility on issues of democracy and human rights under Donald Trump?
There are democracies like the United States that have pulled back and retreated, or democracies in Europe who are, you know, figuring out Brexit and looking inward, and there's a certain kind of crisis of confidence among democracies. And so those peoples out there who want what we take for granted, the ability to vote and, you know, again, push back on crummy policies, they're looking for some backup, right? Mm-hmm. China's not going to offer it. And right now, because of our inward focus and some of the dysfunction in major democracies, we're not really offering it. And the U.S., of course, has moved away from even what we had before, which is an inconsistent application of human rights policy. Now we see, you know, great affection for very abusive leaders like Kim Jong-un and Putin and Duterte in the Philippines and so forth. So we're not in the best position to be having their backs. Yeah. You know, fundamentally, it's going to be about whether democracies get their acts together again, whether we see it as in our interest as America to be supportive of, you know, evolutionary change and reform, political and economic reform around the world, or whether we think we can build a wall around our country and kind of wish the world away. And I don't think the latter approach is going to be very effective for the American people, first and foremost.
Well, like I said at the outset, your book is surprisingly hopeful, and you came out of government with your idealism intact and even strengthened by the experience. So I'm hoping you can give some words of encouragement for those contemplating a similar path. We've seen a massive drain of talent from the State Department under President Trump as seasoned career diplomats have gotten frustrated and fed up and left foreign service altogether. So now there's a real need and opportunity for young people to enter the field. What kind of advice would you give to those considering a career in foreign service?
I think we get the country and the world that we work for. And there are these new forces that we've just been discussing, like the rise of China and growing inequality around the world, that can be kind of daunting. But time and again in our history, the thing, the factor that has been the most determinant in whether we see, greater access to education, greater access to civil and political rights, greater economic opportunity. What dictates that is citizen engagement, mm-hmm. public engagement. You know, it's not like we won World War II just because FDR, made the decision to stand up and lead in the way that he did. We won World War II in part because of the incredible domestic mobilization that we experienced. Civil rights were expanded for African Americans in this country for all the imperfections and the injustices that persist today. They were expanded not because a president decided to grant those rights, but because people came out into the streets from all backgrounds and claimed those rights. So on the Foreign Service and the Diplomatic Corps specifically, I would just say this is a wonderful time to join the Foreign Service because Foreign Service applications are way down because so many terrific mid-level and senior people have left and there are all kinds of opportunities. But, diplomacy becomes more, not less, important as your relative strength declines. And mm-hmm. the one thing we know looking 50 years ahead is, of course, with China's rise, America's relative economic strength and many other dimensions potentially of its strength, that is not going to be what it was. And that's when it becomes incredibly important to build coalitions, to work with other countries to deal with shared threats that affect all democracies and non-democracies equally, like climate change. And so just the opportunities to make a difference from within the diplomatic corps are going to expand exponentially, I think, in the coming years. And I can just say on the basis of having had the privilege of being an activist, a columnist, a professor, and a diplomat, there's really nothing like serving one's community or one's country. It's an immensely meaningful experience and one for which I remain incredibly grateful. And so to even have a taste of that experience, even if it isn't for your whole career, it will change you and enrich your own life and give you the opportunity to do something for your fellow citizens. It's pretty awesome.
Well, if there's any justice in the world, hopefully in the next couple of years, we'll see you returning to the State Department. Once more, Ambassador Power's terrific book is called The Education of an Idealist, a memoir. Samantha Power, it's been such a pleasure. Thanks for talking with me.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks again to Samantha Power for coming on the show. Order her new book, The Education of an Idealist, a memoir, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Keep up with her at SamanthaPower.com and on Twitter at @SamanthaJPower. If you enjoyed today's podcast, be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts and rate and review us while you're there. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show. You can also follow us on Facebook or on Twitter @KickassNewsPod and recommend us to your friends on your social media. For more fun stuff, visit kickassnews.com, and I welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.